morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Today is Tuesday, February the 1st. Here are some of the stories we're covering for you this morning. Mali declares the French ambassador persona non grata and gives him 72 hours to leave the country.
There has been this war of words that's been going on between Bamako and Paris now for several years, but it's just really been in the last couple of months that it's reached a new level.
And rescue efforts continued across southeastern Africa Monday for thousands of people cut off by flooding from last week's tropical storm Anna.
44 hours alone, a total of 44 camps have been set to accommodate the displaced. But the figures might rise because the council is still conducting some assessment.
In Kenya, police say one suspect has been arrested after an improvised explosive device killed at least 13 passengers and injured others in a bus. We'll have those stories and more coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. Stay tuned. And for our top story, Mali gave the French ambassador 72 hours to leave the country after what it said were hostile and outrageous comments by former colonial power France about its transitional government. Relations between Mali and France deteriorated this month when the junta reneged on an earlier agreement to organize elections in February and instead proposed holding power until 2025. The move was opposed by ECOWAS, which imposed sanctions on Mali, and the French government, which has had troops in the country since 2013. But is there perhaps another issue that is driving the wedge between the two countries? For that, I reached Catherine Field, a reporter and political analyst based in Paris.
The main problem, really, for the French is the presence of the Wagner paramilitaries in Mali. That has really been, a red line that the French were not prepared to put up with. And yeah, there has been this war of words that's been going on between Bamako and Paris now for several years, but it's just really been in the last couple of months that it's reached a new level. And we think back just last week, the French foreign minister claimed that the junta in Mali was illegitimate, was being irresponsible in its decisions about the deployment of European special forces in the country. And then you had the French defense minister. She came out, she accused the junta of provocations. And again, she said, and this was just at the weekend, she said French troops would not stay in Mali at any price. So we've been having these war of words that's been going on for a long time. But to be honest with you, Jackson, no one thought it would come to a point where a former French territory, Mali, would expel a French ambassador. This has really taken all the uncertainty, all the miscommunications to a whole new level.
Now, Catherine, the European allies last Friday agreed to come up with plans in the coming weeks on how to continue their fight against ISIS in Mali. How would they do it if they don't have the support of Mali? How effective would the fight against ISIS be if they're not involving Mali?
The word here is that it has been a concern that Mali hasn't been playing with, if you like, a straight bat for quite some time. And the French have already, along with their European allies, been looking at other ways that they can try and halt this march of the jihadists across the Sahel. So in particular, the French and other European partners have been looking at how they can defend Côte d'Ivoire and how they can defend Senegal, which of course are the major transport hubs for the region. That is where goods get circulated from there. So that's very important. But also what they're concerned about now, and they feel that they could work this out, is that they rely very much on Niger. They do what they can to protect Niger. And they also do what they can to look after Benin and Togo and to make sure that the threat from jihadists doesn't creep in as far as Benin and Togo, all the time realizing that you've got a region that's had five coups in the last 18 months. And it's not as simple as military planners sitting here in Paris deciding where they're going to have special forces going.
That was Catherine Field, a journalist and political analyst, arrested her in Paris. And still in Mali, the military junta was infuriated by statements made by French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Rodrien after he said that it was illegitimate and out of control. Mohamed Salaha is an independent journalist based in the Malian capital, Bamako. He tells VOA's Peter Cloti that the expulsion appears to have popular support in the country, despite concerns that it will be costly to the West African nation.
Yeah, this is true. It's confirmed. You know, here in Mali, people, most of Malians support the decision of the transition because the problem in Mali, we have a population with most of them are not literate. So they did not use the negative impact that could be on the country. So it's a very bad decision that the junta has taken. But the junta have the support of the populace. If you saw the last protest they organized, so it was a good mobilization. So they have the support of the populace, and people are commenting this decision all around in Mali right now on social media, and people are commenting with it.
Why did you think the military junta took this decision at this time?
Because it's clear the military junta wants to end cooperation and partnership with France, and they are doing it like progressively. If we saw the last 2 days, the last week, and they have like the French Minister of Foreign Affairs and the Malian Minister of Foreign Affairs, so they were like making a diplomatic war through media. So this is the result of those discussions. And if we try to see, it's like something that is being worse. It won't go, and it could given to ending the relationship between France, which is the functionary partner of Mali, and France will also play a key role in the fight against terrorism in the Sahel, and has its bases from bases in Gao, and also France is coordinating Takuba Task Force, which regroup European troops in Mali. So the situation is getting worse.
Where will Mali now get help from in order to fight the militant, because it was one of the reasons why the former president was kicked out?
The option is Russia, because Mali government say that they have an agreement with Russia to send troops. And what makes also us unhappy is that us and the European Union say it's not Russian army, but Wagner private society. So this is also another point which made them mad.
How are people reacting to the fact that Russians have been invited to come and help?
The junta has support in Mali. So people support any kind of decision the junta has taken, but it's not like unanimity. It's not everybody, but most of people are supporting. Most of people are supporting the decision taken by the junta. This is clear in Mali now.
That was Mohamed Salaha, an independent journalist based in the Malian capital, Bamako. He was speaking to VOA's Peter Cloti. And let's go to East Africa in Kenya, where police said that one suspect was arrested after an improvised explosive device killed at least 13 passengers and injured others in a bus traveling in northeast Kenya near the border with Somalia. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Kenyan police in northeast Mandera County say the 14-seat bus was heading to Mandera town early Monday when it drove over a roadside bomb. Kenyan media reports cited witnesses saying they heard gunfire after the deadly explosion. The Nation Media Group quoted the region's police chief, Bunei Rono, saying one suspect was arrested in connection with the bombing and was being questioned. While no group immediately claimed responsibility for the attack, suspicion will fall on the Islamist militant group Al-Shabaab. The Somali terror group has in the past launched several cross-border attacks on security forces and public transportation. The Al-Qaeda-linked group is blamed for most of the northeast and coastal region's attacks, though analysts say some of the violence is due to local and political disputes. Al-Shabaab in 2015 attacked a convoy on the same road as Monday's attack that was carrying Mandera Governor Ali Roba, killing three people, including two police officers. Kenyan police say suspected Al-Shabaab fighter on Wednesday sprayed vehicle carrying judicial officials with bullets in nearby Lamu County, injuring several people. Mohamed Yusuf for VA News, Nairobi.
Citizens of East African neighbors Uganda and Rwanda have welcomed the opening of the border between the two countries that has been closed for almost 3 years. Local traders say that the two countries should continue working towards a positive relationship by embarking on socio-economic projects that bring the two countries together. Reporter Mugume Davis Rwakarinji has more from Kampala, Uganda.
Businesswoman Gideon Atkwase from Kabale District, which borders Rwanda, says she was delighted on the news citizens from Rwanda and Uganda will not be allowed to cross each other country. When borders were closed in 2019, Gideon was forced to close her restaurant that depended on passengers that traveled across Katuna-Gatuna border crossings. The abrupt closure led her to incur losses from foodstuffs and the rent she had paid up front.
Oh, I'm feeling calm. I'm very excited. Very happy and excited. When they open, and all things may be, if they allow, they heavy trucks and buses, they're going to work.
Nicholas Turiahabwe, who operates a tours and travel agency, agrees. Turiahabwe says he believes by opening borders, tourists will now be encouraged to travel between the two East African countries who share some tourism attraction features in mountain gorillas and volcanic mountains.
You know, most guests, when they know that the borders are closed, they always wonder why. And it means there is insecurity in the region. And that is a big hindrance. It scares away the potential travelers. So once they are sure that the borders are open, there's no security question, because there can't be security when actually the borders are open and people are transiting.
The border crossings were closed after the two countries counter-accused each other of engaging in activities aimed at destabilizing each other's security and espionage. There were efforts to mend the two countries' ties mediated by Angolan President João Lourenço, but efforts stalled after COVID-19 struck. Monday's opening of the borders came after a series of meetings between the leadership of the two countries, the latest being the visit to Rwanda of Uganda's first son, Moses Kainerugaba, who's also a senior army official. Speaking at an event on Saturday in Uganda, Donald Kaberuka, Rwanda President's envoy, said the two neighbors are meant to live peacefully side by side.
We know all that in recent times there have been some challenges, but we also know that significant efforts by our two leaders are underway to resolve those issues, because they are resolvable. We're brothers, and we have the ability to work together to resolve those problems so that we can go on with developing our two great countries.
Socio-political analyst Goroba Mutebi says the two countries have lost economically because of the last 3 years of border closure. Rwanda in terms of much-needed imports and Uganda in formal exports.
The businesses at the border were more inside Uganda than on the Rwandan side. So the small and medium-scale businesses on the Ugandan side collapsed massively as a result of lack of traffic and therefore lack of customers. The way of avoiding this in future is for the two countries not to find themselves in the same spot again, where one is accusing the other of undermining its security.
Uganda exported to Rwanda goods worth more than $200 million by 2018, according to the World Bank. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
Rescue efforts continued across southeastern Africa Monday for thousands of people cut off by flooding from last week's tropical storm Anna. The storm killed at least 90 people across Madagascar, Mozambique, and Malawi. Experts say a fresh cyclone forming near the island nation of Mauritius could hamper rescue efforts and worsen damage in the region. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
The storm damaged public infrastructures, including healthcare facilities and roads, and interrupted healthcare delivery to people affected by the storm. The Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says the storm killed 20 people in Mozambique and displaced 121,000 others. In Madagascar, according to the Africa CDC, 48 people were killed and 148,000 others left homeless. In Malawi, the Department of Disaster Management Affairs says Tropical Storm Anna killed 32 people and displaced 188,000 from their homes across 17 districts. Chibiriro Kamula is the department's spokesperson.
For Chikwawa alone, a total of 44 camps have been set to accommodate the displaced. But the figures might rise because the council is still conducting some assessment, and the general public will be updated on any development.
On Thursday, President Lazarus Chakwera declared a national disaster in areas hard hit by Tropical Storm Anna and called for urgent assistance to the flood victims. In a statement Sunday, the Department of Disaster Management said relief assistance is reaching some areas, although efforts to access others are hampered by impassable roads. The countries affected by Tropical Storm Anna are concerned by reports of a fresh tropical cyclone known as Batsirai is forming near the island nation of Mauritius. However, weather experts in the region have downplayed those fears. Yob Kachiwanda is the spokesperson for the Malawi's Department of Meteorological Services. He says tropical cyclone Batsirai is currently still in the Indian Ocean, east of Madagascar.
And at this stage, of course, the track is not very certain. So more of its possible track will be determined in the next few days. But otherwise, for now, no threat to my weather. But if there be any pause of threat to my weather, the Malawians will actually be informed accordingly.
If it does approach Malawi, he advises people in flood-prone areas to take heed of any warnings from weather experts and officials.
If they are saying to high ground, they should act immediately because these threats are there as climate change is with us.
President Chakwera offered similar advice Monday when he visited flood victims in the Chikwawa and Nsanje districts in southern Malawi. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
As more discussions center on development finance to reduce energy poverty, a new study from the Center for Global Development highlights the fact that Americans and UK citizens, on average, emit vastly more amounts of CO2 than the average person living in sub-Saharan Africa. On the first day of the year, the average American had already emitted more CO2 than the average citizen of Democratic Republic of Congo will all year. The author of the study, Ewan Ritchie, spoke to Ricky Shryok about what these inequalities mean.
We all know that there is a big disparity in energy use and CO2 emissions between these regions, but I wanted to kind of highlight just how big that disparity is. And actually, I was even quite surprised calculating, doing the number crunching and finding that, you know, it's orders of magnitude more energy use in the UK or the US, which means that just a few days of living in the UK or the US, the average person will use more energy than someone from sub-Saharan Africa is likely to in the entire year.
And what does this mean in terms of when we talk about green financing, financing for carbon emissions, financing for fossil fuels, et cetera, things like that? How should the conversation shift given this information?
So I think there are two main conclusions that I would take from this. One is that taking a hard line against funding for fossil fuel projects in Africa doesn't make sense and is likely to prolong energy poverty on the continent longer than is necessary. So there's nearly 600 million people who don't have any access to electricity on the continent. And it's widely understood that due to technological issues with trying to power the grid using 100% renewables, that's not going to change unless there's still, a role for fossil fuels, particularly natural gas, in addressing the energy poverty. And the second is that basically nothing really that African countries do is going to have a big impact on global emissions. Even if sub-Saharan Africa doubled its electricity consumption overnight, and that was all powered using natural gas, it would still add less than 1% to global emissions. And therefore, basically, it's much more important that the rich countries try and tackle their own fossil fuel use, stop using fossil fuel subsidies to encourage more use of fossil fuels, and also stop expanding their own fossil fuel infrastructure. For example, the UK is has currently just approved an expansion of a coal mine in Wales, which will produce 40 million more tons of coal. And the US has been pushing for lower, for extra oil production to bring down energy prices in the US. Stopping that is much more important than restricting funding for some fossil fuel projects in Africa.
That was Ewan Ritchie, author of a recent study on CO2 emissions. He was speaking to Ricky Shryok from the United Kingdom. And for our final story, a Nigerian charity that teaches chess to children living in the country's slums has received a boost from American socialite Paris Hilton. The media personality's tweets this month have helped a group known as Chess in Slums Africa raise more than $100,000 to expand its program. Timothy Obiezu reports from Lagos.
Nigerian chess master Tunde Onokoya and his teammates at Chess in Slums Africa arrive at the Oshodi slum community in Lagos, Nigeria, for an important assignment to teach chess to the kids who live there. The nonprofit has been running chess classes there for 4 years. Onokoya says the idea is to give kids a better chance at education and in life through the chess program.
You know, one of my favorite chess analogies is in that innate ability of a pawn in the game of chess to become a queen. So this is deeply reflective in what we're trying to do with Chess in Slums, right? To show that beyond the stories of poverty, right, every child has potential to become so much more.
Oshodi is one of the most dangerous slum communities in Lagos State, with a history of organized gangs, armed robbery, and street violence, making it difficult for kids to thrive. Onokoya's initiative is to change the negative stories with positive thinking and education. And he says that more than 500 kids from various slums have benefited from his chess program, and that the initiative is expanding to other African countries.
And we started having success stories. A lot of the children we trained started getting scholarship opportunities. You know, they started getting, it now became a gateway to life-changing opportunities for them. Their stories were celebrated in international media, make global headlines.
18-year-old Ojo Ayomide joined the team some 6 months ago and is already dreaming big.
I want to be a chess master. Even though I'm a musician, so I can sing. Maybe they want to help me to take me to studio, and I will be going to school.
The Chess in Slums initiative gained traction in early January after American socialite and businesswoman Paris Hilton retweeted a notice about the program and joined the campaign to raise $1 million for the project. Her tweet about the program immediately boosted online donations from about $50,000 to $100,000. Erin Thompson is a programs director at Chess in Slums Africa.
Once she did that, Tony and I had gotten a lot of meetings, and we were like, okay, how do we set up a global ambassadorship project? Because now that Paris Hilton is doing this, we can kind of present the ability to be a global ambassador to her. And that's kind of like the next step, is making sure we have global ambassadors either for fundraising.
For now, Onokoya and his team say with more funds, they will be expanding the Chess in Slums Africa initiative with the goal of reaching 1 million underprivileged African children over the next 10 years. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Lagos, Nigeria.
And that's it for this edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this morning with us. For more African news and features, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Just search for VOA Africa. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very good morning, Africa.